This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Pandemic lockdowns aren't slowing down our shopping habits. Instead of spending time and money at the mall, many are turning to online retailers for fashion. Shein, a Chinese clothing company, had its biggest year of sales during the pandemic. Last month, it overtook Amazon as the most downloaded shopping app in the iOS App Store. And according to data from Earnest Research, Shein comprised 28% of U.S. fast fashion sales, surpassing H&M, Zara, and Forever 21 last month. Here to talk fast fashion and sustainability are Professor Natasha Radcliffe-Thomas. She's a professor of marketing and sustainable business at the British School of Fashion. Natasha, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us, Alden Wicker, a journalist and the founder of EcoCult.com. That's a platform dedicated to sustainable fashion. Alden, welcome.
Hi, Jen. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's start with this question that Chris writes on Facebook. What is the difference between fast fashion and cheap fashion? Walmart, Target, and pretty much every retail outlet has clothing made outside the U.S. Aren't they all held to the same ethical concerns? So I'll just kick things off for us with a quick definition. What is fast fashion?
So fast fashion is fashion that is not created in seasonal collections ahead of time, but is just created on the fly according to what trends are coming up or what celebrities have been seen wearing out and about. So it's always churning through, and it's cheaper and, of course, faster. It might be shipped instead of by ship, by airplane, so flown across the world so it gets here within a few weeks.
And what is the distinction between what we would see from Shein, what we might see at Walmart or Target?
So Shein has taken the concept of fast fashion and stretched it way further. So it's even cheaper, even faster. It's just trying to scrape the bottom of what is possible in terms of turning fashion into a completely throwaway commodity. So something that has almost no value, you can wear it once, throw it out, and you feel no pain in your wallet from doing that.
Natasha, how has fast fashion changed through the years? Let's look at the store Zara, for example.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, because when we think of fast fashion nowadays, it has a lot of negative connotations. The origins really were kind of trying to, I suppose, democratize fashion. And someone like Zara, when they came on the scene, you know, their ambition was to bring the runway trend straight into the, you know, into the high street retailers, so that you could be wearing the same things as you were seeing on the runway within a matter of weeks. And so it was really kind of trend led. But that's, I suppose, due to economic efficiencies, just as Alden said, that system has speeded up. And so it doesn't sort of reflect any kind of seasons now. It's really fashion on demand.
Mm. Alden, what's the history of these super popular online retailers like Shein and ASOS? When did we start to see those emerge?
So actually, we started seeing something that I like to call, or a lot of people like to call, ultra fast fashion emerge probably 4 or 5 years ago with your British brands Boohoo and Missguided, which also made a big splash in the United States. And they came in and started undercutting H&M and Zara and Target and Walmart, in not just in their speed, but also in their ability to pick up on trends and throw them on the site. Sometimes they'll even use Kardashian model lookalikes to sort of imply that the dress that they're offering for $25 or $15 is the almost exact dress that one of the Kardashians wore maybe a week ago.
Mm. And how would you describe Shein to someone who's never heard of it? They're like, what are they talking about?
It's sort of like, Shein is sort of like as close as you can get to frictionless sort of binge shopping on social media. So instead of having the thoughtfulness to sort of go online even, or go to a store definitely, but go online and sort of say, okay, like, let me look around at everything and see, you know, what appeals to me. I'm looking for something specific. It's just sort of brings mindless scrolling and one-click shopping to your phone in a way that really tugs on your emotions, the way the algorithm of Instagram or even more accurately, TikTok does.
And I think it's fair to say that while this is the most popular online retailer in the world, it's still relatively unknown. How did that happen?
I don't know. I mean, even to me, I started seeing its name come up just a few months ago, and it's it's astounding to me that something that, you know, has that's so incredibly massive is flying under the radar of basically everyone except its target market, which is, you know, Gen Z, young, cash poor, but very online, generation.
And we should mention we reached out to Shein for comment, but we didn't get a response. Natasha, what are some examples of popular stores and companies that don't fall under that fast fashion umbrella?
Well, I think what's really interesting in the last few years is that all sort of stores have picked up on this kind of model, and they want to get the kind of efficiencies that someone like Shein or ASOS or Boohoo have. And I think what it is more about is the price point, because anyone who's trying to deliver, you know, really good economic value cannot really undercut these practices. But what I would say is a lot of it is really supported by the technology. And I think someone like Shein has the advantages of the data analytics, and that's really where their strength is. And they're really responding, as Alden said, to sort of algorithms and really picking up on the pulse of what people want. I think there's an opposite movement, though, from some brands who are trying to be more sort of slow and stepping out of the system. And it's something that we'll have to wait and see whether it's successful or not, because during all the sort of lockdowns, a lot of, you know, the fashion organizations like the CFDA and the British Fashion Council were talking about resetting fashion and really wanting to slow down the pace. But we don't really have a workable model for that as such.
We'll be back with more on our conversation on fast fashion after the break.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Joe knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. This message comes from Capital One. With the Capital One Venture Card, you earn unlimited double miles on every purchase every day. And you can use those miles toward travel expenses like flights, hotels, rental cars, and more. Just book and pay for your travel using your Venture Card and redeem your miles toward the cost. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USANA.
We live in a world, a country, and a moment in time where there's so much important news, and it is constantly changing. That's why Up First is here for you. It's NPR's daily morning news podcast. In about 10 minutes, you can start your day informed. Listen to Up First on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get back to our conversation about fast fashion. Well, let's bring one more voice into the conversation. Dana Thomas is the author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future. Dana, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been writing about fashion for 30 years. How do you react to this boom in ultra fast fashion?
Well, I find it a bit disheartening because, you know, once you've written a whole book on the horrors of fast fashion, you really hope that somebody's read it and has listened. It's very disheartening because we're all obsessed, I mean, as we need to be, with climate change and worrying about the planet, and yet we're burning through clothes at an exponential rate, and where do they all wind up? In landfill, a moldering for eternity, because most of them are made of plastic, and which is what polyester is, and will never biodegrade. So while we say we care and we really want to, you know, we can recycle all our plastic bottles that we want, we're still burning through clothes at an unprecedented rate, and the impact is immeasurable on the planet.
Alden, I want to circle back to the whole idea of people being cheap. Sedge emails this: I think the increasing popularity of cheap fast fashion is largely due to the sharp increase in housing costs over the last decade. Looking at humanity's basic needs, food, clothing, and shelter, it's generally easier and healthier to reduce spending in the clothing category. I believe that also helps explain the popularity of thrift stores. And we'll talk more about thrifting a little later in the hour. But, you know, there is a reality. Wages have stagnated. Lots of people are out of work. People still need to get dressed. So how does that fit into this conversation? Because some people, I can hear people saying, I'm not cheap, I'm broke.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a fair thing to say. Fashion is one of the only product categories that has shrunk its share of how much budget people put towards it. You know, food prices have gone up, housing prices have indeed skyrocketed, you know, transportation costs, all of these things. And clothing is necessary, right? We can't walk around naked. We need something to keep us warm in the winter. So, and I totally, absolutely get that. At the same time, I still don't believe there's evidence that everybody who shops at Shein and other ultra fast fashion brands are, you know, really low on budget. And I do remember being in that place when I was 16, where, you know, Express was like a huge splurge for me, and like maybe I could get a, you know, a shirt there one day. And Abercrombie and Fitch was like way out of my budget. But you know, teenagers are gonna buy as much as they can, and you know, there is a disconnect where people, they want to do well for the planet. And I think about my nieces in this way. They're very much into climate change, but also, you know, they love to shop. So it's just sort of the hedonic treadmill, right? Like, people are just going to prioritize where they're going to prioritize. And if fashion is getting ever cheaper, it's just really hard to keep in mind this sort of person that you've never met across the world who may or may not be being exploited by this, and also sort of this grand idea of climate change, which, mm-hmm. and it's a lot to put on a consumer to expect them to keep all of this in mind.
Well, we heard from a number of you online about how fast fashion can sometimes be the only plus size clothing option available. Nicole tweets, I'm fat, broke, and still want to look cute for girls' night out, brunch, and dates, so fast fashion it is. I also don't have the patience or eye for thrift styling, so no, I don't prioritize sustainability. Nia tweets, definitely with plus size fashion, I'm not able to think sustainability. There was already not a lot of cute plus size clothes to begin with, so I resort to Fashion Nova, Pretty Little Thing, etc. And Jordan tweets, because I'm plus size, fast fashion is often the way I go for trendy clothes that fit my budget and my body. I hate Shein and everything they stand for, but I still buy. Now, Alden, you run EcoCult.com, which is a blog focused on sustainable fashion. How does size inclusivity affect how people shop?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I've written about this before, and I've tried to share a small but expanding number of plus size brands that also are focused on sustainability. And yeah, they're more expensive. And also, there's the idea that, you know, true sustainable fashion doesn't have polyester in it or plastics in it, but that actually limits plus size or extended sizing or inclusive sizing shopping, because if you don't have stretch in a piece of clothing, then it's just harder to find a good fit, right? Like, you have to get something, you would have to get something exclusively tailored to your body. And if you don't have, you know, that perfect hourglass shape, then you need stretch. I mean, we all need stretch. Everything, a lot of things do look better when they can stretch out to fit your body. So that is a huge obstacle to accessing what people consider sustainable fashion if you are above a size 14.
Now, Dana, a lot of popular sustainable fashion brands like Everlane, Girlfriend Collective, sell basics and athletic wear. How do you react to the idea that fast fashion is sometimes the only option for people who want to try new clothes, or maybe take some fashion risks?
Well, that's, as everyone else has said so far, we've been conditioned to think it's normal to pay so little for clothes. Clothes have never been cheaper than they are today. We spend between 4 and 5 times less money on clothes than we did a generation ago. We buy 4 to 5 times more than we did a generation ago. I was earning $1 an hour babysitting, and clothes cost the same amount as my teenage daughter, who earns $10 an hour. She has 10 times the purchasing power, therefore she buys 10 times more clothes. We used to come home with 1 or 2 items in a bag. Now we come home with 10. The average garment is worn 3 to 3 times in China and 7 times elsewhere in the world before it's thrown away. 7 times before we throw it away. So we've been conditioned to think it's normal to get a new dress for a Friday night date rather than shopping our closet, because they want you to come in and spend and buy. 6 of the top richest 50 people in the world own fashion companies today. And yet 98% of the people who make fashion are not paid a living wage. So where do you think all that profit is going? the people who make those cheap clothes that you think are really adorable and you wear seven times before you throw it away, if it costs $20, they were paid 20 cents to make it. Maybe we should think a little bit more and invest in our clothing and cherish our clothing rather than throw it away and think about its origins and the impact it has on humanity and the planet and not just what we see in the mirror.
Alden, can you break down sort of maybe some generational differences here? Because the assumptions that people are only, you know, using these pieces of clothing a few times and then throwing them out. And I don't know that that's absolutely true. Maybe somebody's really stretching out the wear on that Shein shirt or those Shein pants because it's what they can afford. So they've got to make them last a little longer. It feels like a lot of the lens of this conversation is coming through what teens are doing. Can you give us any more context there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I have an H&M dress that I bought 10 years ago and it still looks great. So it's possible to shop at these places thoughtfully, right? I mean, if you really are hard up for a budget, then of course, like, find the thing that you love the most and that you're going to wear. It will probably wear out faster. You know, there's there's an old saying that I'm too poor to buy cheap stuff because it breaks so quickly. But, you know, it's interesting to see the waves of this moving through because boomers actually are more likely to shop at a unrecognized fast fashion brand, which is Costco. So they have a lot of cheap fast fashion there and also sort of like logoed brands that the boomer generation really loves. And the boomer generation doesn't necessarily think about sustainability. It's sort of just like, oh, I just want to get the cutest stuff. I know my aunt and my mom both have way more sweaters than they could ever wear in a year. And then you get the millennials who started to care more about this and are moving into having a little bit more money. And then you have I skipped over Gen X, which, you know, was more rebellious and but doesn't really think about this as much. And then Gen Z, which is a little bit has a split personality, cares deeply about climate change, but also cares deeply about looking cute. And I think, you know, as they get older and move into jobs and can afford a little bit more, they're likely to support artists and designers that have, you know, an ethos, but also they're really supporting secondhand fashion, which is affordable and does move pretty quickly. And you can pick up on trends there and experiment. And so that's something that Gen Z is pushing forward.
Dana, when we talk about the environmental impact of fast fashion, what are the biggest polluters? Is it the manufacturer or the single-use plastic packaging or the clothes themselves?
All of the above. Can I have D, all of the above? It's from the factories, which are in far-flung places that we don't see anymore and follow no environmental or safety standards. And there's no government oversight because that's part of the reason they're so cheap for the contractors and for the brands to use. Then there's the shipping all the way around the world. There's the single-use plastic. There's the leftovers going into the recycle, right straight into the dump. You know, less than, you know, single-digit percentage of clothing is recycled or winds up in thrift shops or in charity shops. It winds up in the landfill. Then there's the dyes. There's the processing of tree pulp to turn into rayon. There's all of the chemicals on the cotton, which is just, don't even let's get started there. The dye of denim, which has formaldehyde and all sorts of toxic chemicals in it, and it just gets washed off straight into rivers. And it's on our skin. So, you know, once you start digging into what goes into making clothes that are not quote unquote sustainable, it's a little bit horrifying. It's kind of like the fast food industry, and you start finding out what's really in that hamburger meat, and you go, oh my gosh, I had no idea. If I did, I wouldn't do that.
Natasha, for designers who are trying to move in the other direction, What are they thinking about in terms of the textiles they use?
It's a really interesting question, and this is one that's so complex even for designers, because whilst we might think, well, natural fibers are definitely the best choice, there's also resource impact. You know, when we're looking at something like cotton, which is one of the most widely used textiles, that uses a lot of water in its production. And then we need to think about whether we're dyeing things and that type of thing. So it really is a challenge. But what I would say is, in terms of something that's going to biodegrade at the end of its life, then definitely natural fabrics. But something like linen is getting a lot of interest from designers at the moment, because it's a really sustainable and hard wearing crop. And so we're seeing a lot of interest in sort of innovators in looking at some of those more traditional fabrics and maybe bring those back into the fashion scene.
We'll be back with more on our conversation on fast fashion after the break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Wyzant, a one-to-one tutoring alternative to online classes where you can learn face-to-face online. Get help with tackling new subjects and career skills, or just catching up. Wyzant lists thousands of personal instructors in over 300 subjects, available for live, individualized lessons with their online learning platform. Head to wyzant.com to find your perfect instructor. Love it, or your first hour is free. Because at Wyzant, we take learning personally.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
We're discussing fast fashion. Let's get back to the conversation with this tweet from Kim. I absolutely think about sustainability as well as ethical workplace practices when I shop. I have also adopted a more minimalist approach to clothing purchases. It allows me to shop my conscience and appreciate my closet more. Dana, can you explain a bit about the workplace practices at fast fashion companies?
Absolutely. I went to Bangladesh and saw the sweatshops right off of the airplane, but also I saw them in Los Angeles. And we don't think about sweatshops in America because we have the Labor Department that enforces these labor rules throughout the country. But sweatshops, underground sweatshops, most definitely exist. And about half the clothes in downtown LA are made in illegal sweatshops with people who have no papers and are paid $2 an hour instead of the minimum wage, which I think is working its way up to $15 an hour in California, and no benefits whatsoever. And then they have to cash their checks at the check cashing place owned by the guy who paid them, so they lose half their check there. These places are rat traps, and they are fire traps. And you know, even in downtown LA, the fire escape is falling off the wall. You don't want to walk on it, much less, you know, and then it only goes halfway down the building. And it's in right there in downtown LA, steps from Disney Hall, you know? And you go like, how does this keep going on? And the Labor Department does what it does. It can to fight them. But these brands that we know in America, like Forever 21 and other American fast fashion brands out of LA, they source from these companies and these workshops. And you go, how and why? And they keep saying, well, we didn't know that they were subcontracting to sweatshops. They know everything. If the color isn't exactly the color they ordered, they'll send it back. If the button isn't exactly where it should be, they'll send it back. You're going to tell me they don't know where their clothes are made? That's bunk. So, you know, and when we see Made in America, we think, oh, it must be fine then. But a lot of it isn't. So basically, if you're buying fast fashion, you're buying into this machine where 98% of the people who make the clothes are not paid a living wage, which is just the minimum we need, economists say, to house, clothe, and feed our families. And we can say we can't afford it. Listen, I'm a writer. You think we have any money? But, you know, we're contributing to our own poverty in a sense. Say you work at one of these stores, you work at Walmart, and you're underpaid. So then you say, I can't afford to buy more. So then I'm going to shop in these stores where everyone else is underpaid. And we all become part of this machine where everyone is not valued as they should be, including what they're making. So we need to, if we can, just rise up a little bit. If it means you have to pay 50% more for something great, it's going to last you twice, three times, four times, five times as long, and it will look so much better. One of these fashion brand CEOs once told me, a fast fashion item never looks as good as the first time you wear it. He's not kidding. And just a general rule of thought, if it costs more to dry clean it than replace it, then you probably shouldn't be buying it.
Natasha, that does raise this question about transparency, and especially when we're talking about online retailers, how transparent do they have to be about their labor practices?
Well, I think one thing is that we really need government legislation on this. But I think at the moment, the push is coming more from the consumers. I mean, as we've heard, younger people are increasingly interested in sustainability. And one of the ways that they see this evidence is through talking about factories that people are using. And it's become quite a popular thing now on websites to show, you know, these are the factories we're working with and to show sustainability credentials. But of course, they're only going to tell you the bit of the story that they want to tell you. And this is where we have the trouble of sort of greenwashing and kind of, the lack of transparency, because at the moment they're divulging what they want to tell you. They can show you the factories they source from. They can talk about materials that they use, but they're not going to tell you the negative parts of the story. So that is a bit of a problem. Plus, it's complicated for people. A lot of people don't want to. I mean, some people are not interested in that. Even those of us who are interested, it's a bit of a minefield. How do we unpick all of this? How do we know how to rate and rank, you know, what we're seeing there? But I do think it's been really interesting to me through the lockdown and the pandemic that we've all become experts on supply chains. You know, we all started to think about, you know, where do our clothes come from? Who's making them? There was a big campaign called Pay Up when the factories got closed down and orders were cancelled. And I think this has come to people's consciousness a lot more in the mainstream. So, and I think once that knowledge is sort of out of the box, I don't think it's going to go back. And I also think there's a lot of pressure from within the industry. So I think there are lots of people working within brands who want to do, you know, it's not nice to work for a company if you don't think they're actually doing the right thing. So I think we're kind of having pressure externally and internally, but it also is going to come in terms of legislation with things like extended producer sort of liability, where brands are going to be responsible for, you know, not just all the supply to the store, but then what happens to their goods afterwards, as we have with other items like white goods. So I think it's going to come that way, and people will have to sort of sign up to letting us know a little bit more of their production. But I think one of the things at the moment that we haven't really talked about is the finance of this and the tax breaks that these online retailers get that enable them to, you know, charge the low prices that the physical stores can't. So that's a kind of bit of a, it's not exactly not transparent, but it's something that's sort of almost staring us in the face, but we don't really notice it so much.
Just want to mention, Forever 21 has been investigated for sweatshop conditions, but 1A and NPR can't confirm those claims of illegal labor independently. Dana, how do you react to the sense of really the onus is on the companies themselves, and whether I buy the $6 top or not isn't going to make a huge difference?
It is on the companies. I mean, come on. And you know what? No company, in fashion or otherwise, is going to say voluntarily, we're going to spend more money in production and have less profits in order to do the right thing. They won't do the right thing unless there's legislation and there's regulation. And fashion is one of the most deregulated industries we have today. I mean, if you applied the rules that we have in fashion to any other major industry, say automobiles, you could say, we don't know where the car parts are made. Can you imagine? Or in the airline industry, we don't know where the engine was made. What are you talking about? They would never get away with that in any other industry. There are some governments now that are stepping in and looking into putting in legislation. Germany is reviewing this and saying, listen, should we just say that we can't import clothes from countries that don't meet our labor standards and our safety standards, which means pretty much every place that the clothes are coming from outside of the EU. And most of them are coming from outside of the EU. You know, we used to make like more than 90% of our clothes in the United States at the height of globalism. It dropped down to 2%, and 98% was made overseas. And as I said before, 98% of people are not paid a living wage. So basically, everybody isn't paid a living wage is making your clothes, except the people who are making uniforms in America, because that's the last holdout. Thanks to legislation and regulation, all military uniforms must be made in America. That's the only reason we still have a domestic industry. It's coming back slowly through things like tax breaks and also what I call right shoring, where they're taking the old factories in the Carolinas, for example, and refitting them with state-of-the-art machinery and reopening them as 21st century factories with robots and vacuums to clean the air and safe work environments and better pay because you're running computers instead of running these horrible sewing machines and bad pay. Labor's coming back. The quality of clothes is coming back. There are reasons for hope, and that hope will hopefully cut or at least dim the light and the heat that comes from fast fashion. We'll all turn to something better.
Natasha, what about from you? For people especially who feel overwhelmed by the whole thrifting experience, or who just like, look, I'm not that style savvy. This isn't my lane. I just need stuff I can put on and feel comfortable in. Any advice or any eco-friendly brands that you think about?
I mean, I think in the States you have a really good example of someone like Eileen Fisher, who really has thought about, again, this sort of having basics, having really wearable pieces. I mean, they're going to cost more, they're expensive materials, but also you can repurpose them at the, you know, when you're finished with them. But I also think a lot of the kind of department stores are moving into this space, and they're curating kind of secondhand clothes for you. And also people are sort of having remake surfaces. So I think there's a lot more kind of opportunities, you know, for customizing pieces that you've bought that maybe you're not quite sure about. Again, we're seeing a lot of people turning to making their own clothes, which is really, as a maker myself, that's really pleasing. So, but I think clothes should be about your identity. You should be feeling good in them. And I think it'd be really nice to have a bit more of that positive space in there. And I think, interestingly, from the research we've done, a lot of people don't mind buying fast fashion if they actually buy it from a thrift store. So they sometimes watch the piece, you know, maybe it's a Zara jacket they're really keen on, but then they just wait till it comes through into the thrift store and they'll buy it there and they'll feel less guilt about it. And they're also maybe doing good for, you know, for charity out of that.
That's Professor Natasha Radcliffe-Thomas. She's a professor of marketing and sustainable business at the British School of Fashion. Also with us today, Dana Thomas, a journalist and the author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes, and Alden Wicker, a journalist and the founder of EcoCult.com, a platform dedicated to sustainable fashion. Thanks to you all for joining us. Today's producer was Arfi Getty. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.